harbor installations of King Herod's great seaport at Caesarea in Israel, to the standard sourcebook on the history of technology in the ancient world. His works on ancient technology are used in dozens of colleges and universities across North America. He has worked both underwater and on land. He discovered a number of deep wrecks in the central Mediterranean while a scientific officer on the U.S. Navy's special nuclear research submarine, the NR-1, a project written up in National Geographic. For the past 15 years, he has directed a major survey and excavation of the desert site of Huimeima in southern Jordan, his topic tonight. Most recently, he has also been studying the Roman technological revolution in concrete, and in September, with two colleagues, reconstructed a Roman concrete harbor feature at Brindisi in southern Italy. He is currently a distinguished university professor at Victoria and is able to spend half his time teaching and the other half on research. His subject tonight is Ancient Huimeima, Water and Society in the Jordanian Desert. Please welcome Professor John Ollison.
Thank you. Thank you. Can you hear me all right in the back? I'm wearing them. Okay, great. I've got a lot of duties tonight, including running the slide projectors. So hang on. Yeah, I don't want that slide. I want everyone. Okay, and now I need to do the lights. Oh, no. How's that? Is that okay? Great. Now I need to deal with this. Well, I want to talk tonight about an archaeological project that's been going on for many years now. It deals with the site of Huimeima, ancient Hawara, which is located about equidistant between Petra and Aqaba in the southern area of Jordan. It's in the region called in antiquity Edom, which means red, and in fact the landscape there has a good deal of red sandstone that you can even see from the space shuttle. That gives the whole area a reddish look to it. A very beautiful desert area, which now is called the Hisma, the southern desert of Jordan. The site was a Nabataean settlement, and we'll come back and explain what the Nabataeans were about a little bit later on, and it survived up into the 8th century AD before being abandoned. I've worked there since 1986. The funding has come largely from the Social Sciences and Humanities Research Council of Canada, and then significant contributions from the Taggart Foundation. I couldn't carry it out, of course, without the assistance of various able colleagues, such as Barbara Reeves and Andrew Sherwood and Eric De Bruin, who is a PhD student here at the University of British Columbia, who's worked with me for many years. There are a number of questions we want to deal with. This won't just be a presentation of some of the recent results at the site, but I want to bring out some of the research questions that I've had to ask over the years and the results, with emphasis in particular on recent results. There's a great deal at the site of Huimeima, and we can't go into detail about all the periods, but I'll bring out some of the highlights. You might ask yourself, how does someone approach the excavation of a large multi-period site such as Huimeima, or the large structures within that site? Because, in fact, over the last 18, 20 years, we've managed to probe sites throughout this large region you see on the screen. I guess my pointer doesn't show up too well, but all of this area is the settlement center of Huimeima, about a kilometer and a half on each side of the square for the major habitation center. So how does one approach excavation of an area of this size? And why was the settlement founded in this particular spot? It looks remarkably unprepossessing to someone from the rainforests of British Columbia. What was the carrying capacity of the landscape? What sort of transitions were there between the nomadic period and the settled period when the Nabataeans arrived? What about the settlement transition from the Nabataean to the Roman period, or the Roman to the Islamic? What was the cultural flavor of the site across time? These are all questions that one has to ask when dealing with such an important, large regional site. It's a very different world in the Hisma. There's 80 millimeters of rainfall or precipitation per year. Vancouver gets about 1,113, depending on which neighborhood you're in, so around 14 times as much rainfall. The modern desert is quite barren, but that's in part from overgrazing over the last century or century and a half. There are just too many sheep and too many goats and camels being put onto the landscape, so a great deal of vegetation has disappeared. It would have looked somewhat more lush in antiquity. And the hunting has reduced the larger wild animals. Until the early 20th century, ostrich were native to the region, mountain lions, gazelle, and hyenas. These are all gone now. But there's still foxes and hares, hyrax, and lots of rodents, and the deeply poisonous snakes that eat the rodents, that live on them. Hard to see here, but there's a desert fox eating a goat that was killed in some sort of accident or by disease off in the desert. They fit in very nicely with the landscape. There's a certain amount of vegetation, too, that escapes the ravenous goats and sheep. Poppies are there, various types of herbs, both thorny and non-thorny, and a variety of very pleasant flowers in the winter and spring. And when you're out in these deserts, you often feel that you're alone. It's a quiet place, a very beautiful place. You don't hear traffic noise. What you hear is the sighing of the wind, the movement of sand across the desert floor, sometimes animals in the distance, often unaccompanied camels wandering from waterhole to waterhole, but sooner or later, a herder will turn up, a goat herd or shepherd, or in this case, a camel herd out in the desert with his camels wandering around in front of him. The Bedouin people who still inhabit the region have been there for hundreds of years. They feel their traditions go back to the 8th century. They feel much in tune with the early Islamic Abbasid family that lived there, and they regard their traditions as valid over several millennia. The tents are still, the black tents are still put up around the landscape. Some of the Bedouin prefer to live in the tents, those that haven't been able to make a living in more commercial jobs here and there in southern Jordan or in the port at Aqaba. Here's a sheikh, as I met him, I think it's around 15 years ago now. He came out from his tent with his cigarette burning and with his ceremonial revolver in his holster to the side. But things change. The Bedouin world is changing. There are many more opportunities for them. The young people go off to university and become doctors and sociologists, and some stay home and herd the goats. But on the whole, the economy is changing very rapidly. The revolvers are even disappearing. In the old days when I'd sit down with the sheikhs to discuss land rental for the excavation and the hiring of Bedouin, they'd shift the revolvers to one side or put them on the table in front of them, depending on what the mood was like during the negotiations. Nowadays, we sit down and people sort of shift their things from their pockets to be more comfortable, and what they pull out are cell phones rather than revolvers. So world changes, everything is different. The older people are often more tied to the past. The young people have more education and have a different relationship to the economy and also to the landscape. people will come to the excavation on their camels, those that don't have little trucks, but the camels are becoming less frequently used for transportation. Some are raised for consumption, others for their milk, but that too is part of a fading ethnographic landscape. The truck is the modern camel, you might say, and most Bedouin trucks are little Toyota Land Cruisers or small Toyota diesel trucks, which are actually painted with the same pigments that they used to use for the camel saddles and for the embroidered saddle blankets that were on top. The town of Humaima was founded as a site called Hawara sometime in the mid-first century BC, mid-first or maybe the last quarter of the first century, depending on whether the Nabataean king Aretas, who founded it, was Aretas III or Aretas IV. In any case, let's say the town was founded in the first century BC by these Nabataeans. You've all probably heard of the city of Petra, that rose-red city, half as old as time, about 80 kilometers north of Humaymah, and the town that was the capital of the Nabataean kingdom. The Nabataeans were a Bedouin group that arrived in this region of southern Jordan probably sometime in the 5th century BC and probably from somewhere in northeastern Saudi Arabia, as we call it now. Their origins are still a little bit disputed because they were beneath the historical radar for a significant period of time. We first hear of them from historians dealing with the campaign of Antiochus I, a Hellenistic king, against Petra in 312 BC. At that time, they were still a Nabataean wandering pastoral people, but they had a capital and religious center at Petra. They ultimately built enormous rock-cut tombs at the site, and around 100 BC, there was a great movement towards urbanization with stone houses and very elaborate public buildings. This is the so-called chazne, or treasury, towards the entrance to Humaymah, probably dating towards the end of the 1st century BC, although that's somewhat disputed. The Nabataeans flourished in contact with the Hellenistic world in the course of the 1st century BC and 1st century AD, and ultimately their kingdom extended from Bostra in the north, not too far from Damascus, out along what reaches towards Iraq and northern Saudi Arabia, down into Hegra, northern Saudi Arabia, the Negev in southern Israel and Palestine, and the heartland, however, was always around the site of Petra, just north of the site we'll be talking about tonight. They flourished in part by pastoral activities, grazing sheep and goats and camels and trading the produce and consuming it. They produced grain for themselves, barley and wheat, perhaps a certain amount of grapes as well. We don't know that they exported foodstuffs, but they did engage in the caravan trade. There was a good deal of movement of caravans north and south along an old highway called the King's Highway that led from Aqaba and some extensions down into the wilds of northern Saudi Arabia. It led from ports along the Red Sea and enabled individuals to bring incense from southern Arabia up through the desert into the settled regions of southern Syria and eastern Palestine. This was a very lucrative trade for the Nabataeans because they would guide people through the desert and take their cut in the profits. Around 100 BC, some of this trading situation changed as their monopoly over access to the harbors in the Red Sea was jeopardized, and the Nabataean king Aretas III in particular began to foster sedentarization. Began to make it easy or facilitate the settlement of some of these pastoral peoples in lands that were at least marginally appropriate for agriculture. This happened at Petra, constructions being built, stone structures that people were living there permanently, and at Humaymah this happened as well, not long afterwards, soon after the town was founded. There was an attempt to set up a more organized Hellenistic type of state as well, as opposed to the loosely organized clan and tribal organization of this Bedouin Nabataean original social organization. We actually have a foundation story for Humaymah, preserved in a Byzantine Greek historian named Ouranios, but working with an earlier source. He says, Awara. This is the name of the town, which is the Greek version of Hawara. Awara, town in Arabia, named by Aretas from an oracular response given to his father, Obodas. Aretas set out in search of the oracle's meaning, for the oracle said, to seek a place, Awara, which in Arabian and Syrian languages means a white place, a place that's white. And as he lay in wait, looking for a vision, a vision came to him of a man clothed in white garments and mounted on a white dromedary. But when the apparition vanished, a craggy hill appeared, quite natural and rooted in the earth, and there he founded the town. So you have a town named White, perhaps as a kind of pun on the white camel, and there was a mountain associated with the foundation of the town as well, which of course you can still see there, what's now called the Jebel Ghana. There are various reasons to suggest why it might have been called white. The most logical is that there are humpy little sandstone mountains to the east of the site and the north of this Ka Disi sandstone, as it's called. They resemble, in a sense, camel humps, and that may be the origin of this idea of a magical white camel that led them, led Aretas to the site where his foundation would be placed. Now, this place looks desolate to our eyes, but there are, in fact, many resources. And to a Nabataean who is used to living in the desert, it would have been almost an ideal situation. There was fairly good soil for agriculture. It's a sandy loess, loess being a soil blown in during the Pleistocene period, which can, in fact, sustain agriculture fairly well as long as water can be gotten to it. There are sandstone hills all around the basins where the loess is found. And during the winter, when rainfall comes, it rushes off these sandstone slopes and filters into the soil at their foot. What the Nabataeans would do in antiquity is what the Bedouin do there today. They would watch to see where the rain fell. They would then plow up the soil and put seed in, and then keep their sheep away for a period of time until the grain had come to be ripe, harvest it, and then feed the sheep on the stubble. You can still see wheat and barley crops around the region today. They're less frequently farmed because the economy is changing, but you can still carry out agriculture in this region. And until recently, it was very worthwhile doing. The same runoff from these hills could fill cisterns and reservoirs, and that, of course, would provide the water necessary for both the flocks and the people. This is a cistern not far from the town center, which was built in antiquity. The niches are for arches that spanned the reservoir and which then carried slabs that formed a roof to avoid pollution and evaporation of the water. We'll see some more reservoirs in the town center in a few moments. So the town had water, it had agricultural land. It also was what we call an ecotone. It was located in an area where you could go to several climatic regions without moving a very long distance. At the beginning of the show, we saw the Al-Shara escarpment. The top of this tall cliff is at 1,500 meters above sea level, whereas the plain where Humayma is located is only at 1,000 meters above sea level. So in the summer, when it's very hot, herders could go up the hills to the north and find pasturage that still was green. Then in the winter, they could go down to the areas in the south, which were lower, and they could find regions that had gotten rainfall during the winter and could pasture their flocks there, well away from the ice and snow of the higher elevations. So there are numerous resources they could access. And then finally, there was a route of passage through the region, a highway that went back to the Bronze Age period, the so-called King's Highway, along which people and trade moved from the north parts of Syria and northern Palestine, down through the central parts of Transjordan, down to Aqaba and the Red Sea, and then farther down south yet to Saudi Arabia. So there was a much there for the Nabataeans to prosper with, and King Aretas, whether it was number three or number four, felt that this was a good opportunity to bring settlement to a significant number of his people. Well, it's a large region then. This is an aerial view of the town center. The dark areas are the remains of shaken down walls from various house structures, most of these from the Byzantine period and probably early Islamic, so that's the later part of the site. Off in the distance is the Roman fort that we'll come and talk about later. It's a large area for an archaeological site. It's very complex. There are numerous chronological periods, so how does one approach this site and approach the excavation? Well, the way I went about it was to do a survey first, and in 1986 and 87, with a small team, I surveyed a good deal of the region, the whole catchment, which is 250 square kilometers, looking for water supply systems and signs of settlement. Well, we found very few signs of settlement, but many signs of an attempt to get water from the landscape, and probably remains of agricultural activity as well. And most of these seem to have been set up in the first century BC. This map shows you the location of Humayma, ancient Hawara. This dotted line is the line of the King's Highway that goes through the region from the tall cliffs up to the north towards the south. All of these dots are various cisterns and other hydraulic installations that we found around the region. We found 61 cisterns, both built of blocks and cut into the sandstone bedrock. They average about 100 cubic meters each in capacity, so you have a total of about 6,000 cubic meters of water storage capacity in the region. There were three dams located here and there with a storage capacity of about 3,500 cubic meters. There was also an aqueduct with two branches coming from two springs up in the escarpment at about 1,500 meters above sea level. They joined at this point, and that's the solid line that came right down to Humaima. It's difficult to restore the discharge of this reservoir, of this aqueduct, and it in fact probably varied from time to time, but it was a very significant source of water as well for the settlement. And then there were three large reservoirs associated with the town center that held a capacity of about 1,400 cubic meters. So we have a regional total of about 12,300 cubic meters of water, and in the town center itself, there was storage capacity for about 4,300 cubic meters. The only addition to this system, and we'll look at this a little later, was a Roman reservoir that was built after the Romans arrived in 106 AD, and that held about 1,200 cubic meters. Otherwise, the Nabataean system as set up in the first century BC survived more or less unchanged through the 8th century AD, a testimony to the thoroughness and the knowledge of the Nabataean founders. Well, water runs off these stony hillsides. There's no soil to soak it up. There's no vegetation to hold it back. So large amounts of water from the winter rainfall can be gathered in cut gutters, cut down into the soft stone, and led to cisterns. Most of these cisterns were cut in the sandstone bedrock. Some of them had natural stone roofs over them. Others had arches that held up slabs, as the one you see here, which has its roof intact, despite the passage of over 2,000 years. The water is in there. The cisterns are lined with plaster. The roofs keep pollution out from the animals that gather around to be given the water, and they also prevent evaporation and the formation of algae and other pollutants within the water from the action of sunlight. We had three dams. This is the most interesting and well-built of them, about 13 meters across from one side to the other. It held approximately 1,500 cubic meters behind it. Very nicely built, tucked back into a gully about 1 kilometer away from the town center. It probably would have served to provide low-quality water to goat and sheep and camel herds in the vicinity of the town center. There was also the aqueduct I mentioned going down from Ain Jamam and Ain Ghana, bringing fresh water down to the town center. It was composed of a series of stone gutters set end to end, cut in the local marl or a type of silty limestone. You see one of the conduit blocks here. These were laid into a framework of larger blocks, and there were stones above to keep sand out and to keep the water from evaporating or being diverted where it shouldn't have been, and it came down to a large pool in the town center. The pool is a very interesting problem. It's 27.6 meters long and 17 meters wide and only 1.5 meters deep. That's a very foolish way to design a reservoir in a desert climate because it's impossible to roof it. You can see it's a very shallow and wide reservoir, very nicely built, but it seems completely impractical. And it's only recently with developments, excavated developments in Petra, that I've realized that it wasn't in fact meant to be a reservoir at all, but a swimming pool. This may sound totally preposterous, but there is very good evidence for swimming pools in desert climates built by despots such as Herod the Great, some of the earlier Jewish kings, and in Petra by Aretas III or the IV, the very person who founded Humaima. In fact, in Petra, an aqueduct was allowed to pour over a waterfall into a large pool next to a paradesos, an ornamental a garden paid for by the king. The point of this was to show off the Nabataean control of the desert. People come in a caravan, foreigners who are not Nabataeans. They see a waterfall in this town center of Petra, surrounded by such arid countryside. It impresses them with the control of the landscape by this Nabataean culture. And I think the same was meant to happen at Humayma. Foreigners would come from the south, from Hegra, 250 kilometers to the south through the very harsh Saudi Arabian desert, or they'd come up the Wadi Yutum from what's now called Aqaba, again through very dry desert, up into this alto plain at 1,000 meters, and suddenly they'd find a pool in the center of the desert, probably surrounded by a garden, and with these happy Nabataeans splashing around. The water could be used, but only for lower quality purposes, because once water is exposed to the air and exposed to pollution by people swimming in it or drawing on it for their animals, you can only use it for irrigation. It's no longer any good for drinking. And the overflow probably was used to irrigate crops just to the south of the city. Nevertheless, it gives you an idea of the importance of water to the Nabataeans, their control of hydrology in this very demanding region, and the fact that they were able to create a system in the first century BC that sufficed for 800 years. Down in the town center, there were several large reservoirs as well, but these had roofs on them. This one was cleared out in the 1960s, and most of the arches were taken away. It was used until very recently as the main water source for people and animals in the area of Humayma that was built in the Nabataean period. One can reconstruct the water system. There are various types of water, regional precipitation. Some is lost. You see some of it going off to the left. Others go into rural cisterns, urban cisterns, impoundment dams. There is local precipitation, which goes into other reservoirs and cisterns, and then their use, rural use, town use, and so forth. We don't have to go into all the details, but one can systematize the approach to hydrology at Humayma in antiquity and see that it was worked out in a very thorough fashion. There was provision of water both in the rural area for individuals who were farming there or taking care of their flocks, and water was focused on the town center where there was the largest population. And it was only with the arrival of the Romans in 106 that there was an addition, a Roman reservoir, which was meant to serve the Roman soldiers contained within the walls of the fort and their mounts, their cavalry mounts and camels. So this system functioned very well and continues, in a sense, to function well today because many of the reservoirs and cisterns continue to be used. The rain falls, it's exiguous still, but it generally falls in predictable amounts. There's a lot of redundancy in the system in that there are reservoirs and cisterns located throughout the region to catch whatever rainfall comes around. And one can calculate in antiquity and for today how many people can be accommodated by the water provided. I've calculated through looking at figures for human needs, minimal needs of consumption in a pre-industrial society, and the requirements of sheep, goats, and camels, that the regional water supply was sufficient for approximately 800 humans, 180 camels, and 1,700 sheep and goats. For humans, for example, I use a calculation of 8 liters of water a day for drinking, washing, and cooking. Now, there was much movement. One could move to better watered areas or areas that get away from areas where the water hadn't fallen that particular year, and one could work out oscillations in the system in this fashion. If you have 800 people, that is 2.2 per square kilometer for the region, and this works very nicely into the modern calculations. In 1970, it was calculated that the population of this region was three persons per square kilometer, as opposed to my calculations for antiquity of 2.2 persons per square kilometer. Well, in this type of landscape, the sheep would be pastured in the lowland areas on stubble from crops during the winter months. In the summer, though, the crops would be growing, and the sheep and goats would pasture in the rocky highland areas. This would be in the, well, let's say the late winter and spring and very early summer until the crops of grain were harvested. So one would sow crops when the winter rains had fallen. The sheep and goats then would be kept away from these fields. You'd lead them to the highlands, where in fact there still was good pasturage at this time, and put your tents where necessary in order to keep watch over them. And there were always cisterns round about these regions for the humans and their animals to draw upon. And then, after the crops had been harvested in late May or early June, you could bring the animals back down into the lowland areas, and they could pasture on the stubble left over from the crops in the fields, which you see happening here very recently in the site. It makes a good deal of sense. It makes use of several parts of the landscape, and it follows the natural course of the annual precipitation. But Hawara, as the Nabataeans called it, was always the center. The largest reservoirs were there. They were open for public use, it's likely, and people could draw water from them for personal use or, to an extent, for their flocks. So it was a very significant center. This is the plan of the structures we've excavated so far. There's the Roman fort, of course, very prominent up in the northern part. We'll talk about the Abbasid manor house in a little bit. There's a civilian settlement of the Nabataean and Roman period just to the south of the fort, and a variety of other structures scattered round about. You've seen from the aerial photographs how extensive the town center is. How did I approach a large multi-period site? What was the way of dealing with some of the problems involved? There'd been virtually no excavation at the time I arrived with my team in 1986, but looking at historical accounts and the ceramics on the ground, and recognizable structures, one knew that the Romans had arrived sometime after 106 AD when they took over the Nabataean kingdom. We knew that there were Byzantine Christians involved with the site because there were remains of at least one church from the 4th or 5th century AD, and we knew that there was extensive early Islamic occupation during what we call the Umayyad period, and that the Abbasid family had actually owned the site from the late 7th to the mid 8th century AD. So I looked around the site to find where some of the most likely spots would be for Nabataean structures and Byzantine, Roman, and early Islamic structures, and we focused at first small probes in various areas, and then as we found likely structures likely to give us good results with further excavation, we excavated those. And gradually, over 20 years, we built up a fine and complete repertoire of sites from all the periods and of the various types of structures, civilian, military, religious, and so forth. What's interesting in some of the early periods is that these settlements would be partly sedentary, partly pastoral. Even in small towns nowadays, in the Hisma and the surrounding regions, there's a very fluctuating urbanism. People will have one or maybe even two cinder block houses, but then when needs be, they will set up some tents around these houses. Here, for example, in the Jaffer Depression, the town of Jaffer, very mobile population. Sometimes they're out in the desert, sometimes they're settled at the town center. So you have cinder block houses, but then there'll be a number of Bedouin tents as well set up. And I think in the beginning, Humayma was much like this. And in fact, one can document it well at Petra, that there were tents scattered about the town settlement, and then gradually houses were built, but tents continued to be set up from time to time as more accommodation was needed, perhaps for the gathering of clans, perhaps for market days, or when caravans passed through. And at Humayma, we can't find the traces of the tent encampments except by elimination. Just to the south of the town, the south edge of the town, there's a round cistern. Elsewhere in the town center, these cisterns built in the first century BC are all associated with houses, with major structures. But at the south end, there's no house associated with it, and it seems very likely that the sherd scatter around was part of an encampment, that the cistern was built to take care of the occasional arrival of clans that needed a domestic water supply but didn't actually need a house in the town center. We have found a few Nabataean houses. They generally are small. There's a courtyard with a door entering into it, and then rooms along the back. Let's see if this thing's not working too well. we go. Some rooms along the back of this courtyard, a very simple type of house, similar to what you see at Petra and other Nabataean towns in the area. We know that there were major religious and public structures built as well, because we have the remains of foundations here and there. We haven't dug any in their completeness, but there are many foundations left that we can see below later structures, and we have the remains of Nabataean capitals and other decorative elements from some of these temples. Here, for example, a Nabataean Corinthian type of capital that has the nubbins broken off the corners, which we found in the Roman fort. These structures mainly were damaged, the public structures, when the Romans came in 106. So there was a flourishing Nabataean town called Hawara. It consisted of permanent houses of significant size, a very well-developed water system, long-distance trade links, a certain amount of political and social stability. But the Nabataean kingdom petered out, in a sense, in 106. Elderly king died. The Romans, under the Emperor Trajan, moved in as part of his long-term strategy to dominate the Middle East. And it used to be thought that the Roman takeover of the Nabataean kingdom was quite peaceful. But we now know through excavation at Petra and at Humayma and a few other sites that, in fact, the appearance of the Romans is associated with destruction of many structures of the Nabataean period. When the Romans arrived, they built a major fort at the north end of the site. A little hard to see here, but we've seen it in previous photographs. Here's the rectangle of the Roman fort, a very large structure compared to the smaller structures you now see in the town center, scattered around to the lower part and the left-hand part of the slide. They probably, about 500 soldiers, a detachment from another legion, were stationed in the fort, judging from its size. What were they meant to guard? It's a little hard to say, but we know that this site was very important to the Romans because our excavation has shown that the fort was built immediately after the conquest, perhaps within the first 2 or 3 years of the conquest in 106. We'll come back to that point a little bit later on. But Hawara, to the Romans, was just as important as the site of Hawara had been to its founder, King Aretas. Well, the site flourished during the period of Roman involvement, and as the Roman-Italian centered rule changed to that of the rule of Byzantium, ancient Constantinople, the town continued to flourish, and we found evidence for 5 Byzantine churches in this small site, built in the 4th and 5th centuries AD. 5 churches is a great many for such a small site with a population perhaps of 500 or so, counting aside the soldiers. Why so many churches? It's difficult to say why. There are all sorts of explanations that have been proposed. The most likely one is that churches were vowed in gratitude for some sort of success by a family or a clan or an individual, and then built as dedications. Most of our churches are rather large for this type of dedicatory church, but it is possible. Or there could have been doctrinal differences, or in many cases, perhaps a larger population coming in from the desert for worship, which would require a larger number of structures. They all seem to have been functioning more or less across the same period, so it wasn't as if the churches were successive one after the other. One finds this phenomenon in some other sites. Petra has a significant number of churches, and sites like Mamsitz or Shivta have significant numbers as well. So the Byzantine period was a flourishing one. We think of the Middle East as being an Islamic region, as it is today, but in fact Islam didn't arrive until the 7th century, and the Arabs were among the earliest enthusiastic converts to Christianity. And of course, there are many flourishing Christian communities in the Arab world today. We may even have had the first Christian emperor may have been Philip the Arab. Somewhat a misnomer, but he was in fact of Near Eastern origin from a town in Syria. It's often said that he might have been the first Christian emperor. In any case, there's good reasons for Christianity to be evidenced at Humayma. But then the forces of Islam coursed over the region in the 640s, 50s, 70s, and in particular, the Abbasid family bought the site of Humaymah. And if you go to Humaymah today, that's a part of the history that's really being played up by the Tourism Bureau. There's signs on the main highway that goes past the site now. It actually is 15 kilometers to the east, but it says Al-Humaymah, the site of the base of the Abbasid family, which doesn't make a lot of sense in English, but you get the idea. It's the center for the Abbasid family. The Abbasids come from Ali, or descendants of Ali, who was the first cousin of the Prophet. The Abbas family spent some time at Udra to the north, and then they purchased Humaymah around 688 AD. And there was Ali ibn Abd Allah ibn al-Abbas, who built a manor house, according to early Islamic historians, and a mosque, and had a grove of 500 olive trees at the site. Maybe he switched from subsistence agriculture to commercial agriculture, to market-oriented agriculture in contrast to the Nabataeans and Romans before him. In any case, the Abbasids made use of the unique position of Humaymah on trade routes and its various resources to plot against the Umayyad Caliphate in the 740s. The Caliphate, the papacy, as it were, the headship of the Islamic religion, located in Damascus at this time. They actually were able to overthrow the Umayyads. They left Humaymah in 749 at the beginning of the revolution, and in 750 started the Abbasid Caliphate. So Humaymah had an important part to play in early Islamic history as well. We actually have found their manor house. Here's an aerial photograph. There's an entrance here, a square courtyard, and a series of rooms around the circumference. You can see it perhaps a little better in this plan. The walls, like the walls of so many of the structures at Humaymah, were made, for the most part, of mud brick, so they've disappeared. We excavated first in a room at the back, which turned out to be something like the throne room of the Abbasid family, or the treasure house of the Abbasid family. We found important frescoes there. We found also remains of a piece of furniture with ivory panels on it. These are a door here with an ivory panel showing a warrior. You see perhaps a warrior's face with a helmet. He's holding a spear in one hand and has very fancy garments on. A little hard to see in the photograph, but I think perhaps his drawing shows it a bit better. Very unique carvings that have show a good deal of Iraqi influence, which is where part of the power base of the Abbasid family was, and shows as well the sophistication and richness, riches of this early Islamic period at Humaymah. Well, there's a rich history then at Humaymah. The Abbasids left around 750, and the town more or less disappears from history until the 1980s when we began work there. I can't give you a full account of all of the excavations, but I thought that I would go through some of our more recent work in the fort and in the civilian settlement just to the south. The fort, of course, you see in the front part of this photograph. The civilian settlement I'm talking about is this area just about 80 meters to the southwest of the fort. There are a number of questions that faced us when we began to work on the fort in 1994, I think it was. When was it built? That was the most important. Most of the forts, virtually all the forts known in Jordan, dated to the reign of Diocletian, 285 to 305 AD. So what was the date, what was the design of the fort, and what unit was stationed there? Well, our excavation in the walls and beneath the various floors in the fort showed right away that the ceramics of the earliest levels dated to the very beginning of the second century AD. So they probably dated right after the period of Roman occupation. It seems as if the Romans considered the site of Hawara a very critical place, and that they brought in soldiers to watch over the markets, to watch over movement up and down the road, to make sure only appropriate individuals made use of the water supply, and to protect trade along the King's Highway. That highway was very important to the Emperor Trajan, seen here on a coin we found at the site, because he rebuilt it, repaved it, and perhaps made some of the slopes easier to use, and put guard towers along it, and he renamed it the Via Nova Traiana, Trajan's New Road. We know that a detachment of the Legio III Cyrenaica, the Legio Tertia Cyrenaica, the 3rd Cyrenaican Legion, was stationed there. And we also know from our archaeological work that the fort was abandoned sometime in the third quarter of the 3rd century AD. We have coins that go all the way up to about 275 AD, and then there's a gap until about 306 AD. This is more or less the reign of Diocletian, but there may in fact have been a destruction earlier. And what I think, and a fascinating possibility, is that the site was destroyed by Zenobia, that rebel, very romantic historical figure, a rebel client queen, a client queen of the in a kingdom that was supposedly loyal to the Romans, who revolted from the Roman Empire in the late 260s and ultimately conquered in 269, 270, a good portion of the Middle East. Here you see Tiepolo's take on Zenobia, talking to her troops before they head south towards Egypt. In 270, they went south. They marched along Transjordan. They would have had to pass right by Hawara and then ultimately captured Alexandria and a good portion of the Egyptian province. Could the destruction of Humayma or the abandonment of the fort have something to do with Zenobia's army passing by at this time? It could well be the case. In any case, there was a resettlement in the fort and other parts of the town around 305, 306, and we have significant remains from the time of Constantine and the House of Constantine. Whether soldiers reoccupied the fort in the 4th century, we don't know. It might just have been squatters, civilians from the town center, but we have to excavate further to figure that out. So we have the fort then. It's obviously a Roman fort, judging from the pottery inside and from the shape and design. It's a rectangle, as you see in this aerial photograph, with gates in the east and west sides and the north and the south. How does one approach excavation of a structure of this size? Well, what you do is you work from the outside in. And what we did was excavate a site from a tower in the wall, a trench across a section of the wall that was well preserved, and some of the gates. Here, for example, a tower. We got an idea of the dimensions of the wall, the dimensions of the tower, and of course chronology by going down to the lower levels of the fort at these places. We excavated the east gate, giving us an idea of its design, of the presence of drains under the gate, and of the dimensions of the roads on the interior, and also, of course, again, looking for the earliest levels. And ultimately, by working around the walls and the gates, and then, of course, probes on the interior, we got a good idea of the fort's dimensions and layout. It was 148 meters wide by 206 meters long, which is exactly 4 millimeters. There were 24 towers around the outside, projecting towers 6 by 20 Roman feet in size. The walls were 10 Roman feet thick. There was a nice reservoir in the northwest corner up here, which was 100 by 50 by 10 Roman feet in size. And sometimes you don't even have to excavate to find out what the design of a structure like this is. We've had geophysical research going on for the last 2 years, and this year some ground-penetrating radar was used in a radial pattern around the fort, and we came up with the surprising discovery, Greg Baker from Buffalo was doing this, that there's a trench outside the walls. You really can't see this even in aerial photographs, and you certainly can't see it on the ground, but it's a characteristic that's very typical of European Roman forts, and it's extremely rare in the Middle East to have a ditch, a defensive ditch around the outside. It's about 5 meters across, 2.5 meters deep, and 5 meters out from the wall. It's right here. It's a little hard to see perhaps in the slide, but there's a line drawn to emphasize where this anomaly comes out in the ground penetrating radar. The projecting towers, the design of the fort, the presence of a ditch on the outside, all of these are very Western European features. That plus the early date of the fort, immediately after the conquest, shows that European military engineers probably were brought in to work with Trajan and set this fort up in a style to which they were accustomed in their home province or provinces. Well, we worked inside the fort. There are a variety of structures we'll look at in the next few minutes. The Principia, which is the headquarters toward the center. We'll look at the Praetorium, which is the residence for the commander, just to the west of it. There's a structure here we'll discuss, Area J, and another one there, and barracks to the south. Well, once we had an idea of the outline of the fort, we started working on the interior structures, and the Principia was, of course, our first focus. It's the headquarters building. We thought we might find inscriptions there, which would give us an idea of the unit that was stationed in the fort. The Principia is the area where the military headquarters is located. There are rooms for meeting. The treasury was often kept there. The standards of the unit were kept in an aides or worship area toward the center of the building. And there were often altars and statues around the Principia too. So we hope to find a little bit of each of these types of evidence. And in fact, a good deal turned up. The structure was very nicely paved with heavy slabs for the most part. There were benches here and there, some of them built of reused Nabataean blocks. Here, for example, these are anti-capitals or bases from the Nabataean period, which had been built into a wall to form some kind of bench, speaker's platform perhaps, or perhaps a platform for dedications. We did find some statue bases, and several of them were inscribed. This was a very large one at the end of one of the colonnades along the sides of the courtyard of the Principia. It had at least two-line Latin inscription on it, but one could only make out a few of the letters, unfortunately. It may have been dedicated to one of the governors of Arabia and a statue located on top of it. Several altars turned up, too. Here's a small one about 80 centimeters tall that has an inscription on it in Greek dedicated to Zeus Capitolios, Capitoline Zeus, a very Roman type of god, and one that points out, again, the Roman nature of occupation in this fort and the ties with the city of Rome, the center of the empire. To the west of the Principia, there was a very prominent structure. There were numerous walls visible, just projecting slightly above the ground. We excavated there in 2000, and again this past summer, 2004, and found a very interesting, well-built structure with mosaics in several of the rooms. A bit hard to see here. We've excavated these rooms in their entirety, but what you have is a series of rooms around a courtyard, which is located over here. We were able to reconstruct the overall plan of the building, at least roughly, by looking at walls that are on the surface. It has a plan that's fairly typical of what we call Praetoria, the residence of a unit commander in a fort. You'll have a courtyard, there are rooms around it. Sometimes there's a bath, as you see here at the Praetorium for housesteads. So given the fittings of this structure and its location and plan, it seems very likely that it's the head of the commander. Here again, the courtyard and the portico around it are paved with the sandstone slabs that can easily be quarried in the region. And the walls had frescoes on them. We haven't found figured frescoes except tiny fragments so far. Generally, these frescoes imitate carved stone panels, sheets of marble veneer, and then you have geometric panels up above with the false veneer down below. So a great deal of care was taken with the decoration of the structure. And then there were four rooms at the northeast corner of the structure that had mosaics. These are the only mosaics that have been found south of Petra in Jordan, so they're extremely interesting and important. You have four rooms here. This actually was a single room originally. This is a later wall. but you have a long rectangular room about, was it 15 meters in length, with a margin around the outside and mosaics in the center. We'll see some details of them in a moment. A door leads into this room, and then a door into the room, and in fact, there was a third room at the end that we'll see in just a moment. Very colorful mosaics. The walls were less colorfully decorated, but still had plaster on them. A long room at this point, and then a series of rooms ending in this structure, which turned out to be a hot bath. There's a furnace entrance just below at this point, we'll look at in a moment. And the room here, not completely excavated, had a suspended floor which could be heated underneath, and of course the water heated as well, so you could have a hot bath. Here's the Pryfernium that gives access to the fire that's built underneath the floor. We cleared out part of the room from of its fill, and you can still see the piles of circular bricks that held up the very large bricks and plaster that formed the radiant heat floor underneath probably some hot water tanks. And I think what we have in this region is a banquet suite combined with a bathing suite. The long, narrow room probably accommodated banquet benches around the edges behind that band that separated the geometric decoration from the undecorated portion of the mosaic. And then next to it, there were a series of two rooms, perhaps an undressing room, and then a room where there were cold bath splashes or plunges. And then you would go into the warm bathroom so you could sweat and splash yourself with hot water and then back out again to rest. So bathing and banqueting could take place in this very well-decorated part of the headquarters building. In the desert, the colors tend to fade very quickly, and particularly mosaics, when they're all dusty, it's difficult to see the colors, so what you have to do is take a mop and water and mop as fast as you can, and then have the photographs taken. And that's always a big challenge at Humaima, because generally photographs are best about 1 o'clock when it's quite hot and the sun evaporates the water quickly, and there's always a stiff wind as well that makes the water disappear. So poor George Bevan here was mopping as fast as he could, and then he'd run away and I'd take photographs, and then he'd mop again and I'd take another photograph, and it always comes also at a time of day when the water is running out. Anyhow, we had nice mosaics, funny sort of heart-shaped blobs in the banqueting area, but I think the banquet couches would have been located around the edges of the building. These mosaics, you can see, were damaged and then repaired. They were damaged during this period after this period of abandonment, sometime around 270, 275, and perhaps it was the result of Zenobia's troops taking over the fort and just destroying whatever they could. Then the fort was reoccupied around 306, and the mosaics were very roughly repaired with slabs of stone and plaster. Here again, you see the mosaic original, and then the slabs set in mortar around it. The mosaics themselves, which were created sometime at the very beginning of the second century AD, are interesting. You have these geometric patterns of squares and triangles. There's a Greek fret motif around the edges. They're intersecting circular forms in one of the other floors. And what's interesting is that we can tell that the mosaic team was actually a group of Nabataean mosaicists, because a villa excavated a few years ago in Wadi Musa shows very small details that are precisely the same. This is a Nabataean mosaic from Wadi Musa, which is the settlement associated with Petra, the modern settlement, and you see the same type of fret. I can't go into the small details. I don't have details that would show up or slides that would show it well enough on this screen, but we can see the same team was being used here that had been working in a Nabataean context before. So it's an interesting phenomenon. The Romans come in, they build a fort, the headquarters building needs mosaics, and the Roman commander hires Nabataeans to carry out the mosaic work. In fact, the whole concept of Romanization at Humaima is an interesting double-edged sword. The ceramics used for the first 50 years in the fort are all what we call Nabataean ceramics, various types of painted bowls and even plainware bowls as well that were manufactured by the Nabataeans and are considered typical of Nabataean culture. So the Romans come in, they build a European-type fort, they have Nabataean mosaics, they use Nabataean pottery, and it's altogether a great cultural mixing going on. And even the coins found in the fort, we find almost as many Nabataean coins in the fort as we find Roman-issued coins. So we know a good deal about the headquarters building, about the residence of the unit commander. We wanted to look at a major structure to the east, and Eric de Bruin's been working on that from UBC over the last couple of years. Very large walls in this structure, 18, 20 meters long. You can see the scale of the structure here. Eric won the prize this year for the longest amount of wall uncovered, but of course he only had to take it down about 10 centimeters or so to bring it out for photography and drawing. A very substantial structure then. We weren't sure at first what it was, but by looking at parallels, we've decided it probably was the granary of the fort. This wall here with the buttresses on it, perhaps for arches or for wall support, there probably was a medial wall along here and another one over there. So we might have two or three rooms, very long and narrow, with very solid walls and very solid paving. That were used to store wheat and barley. That was the mainstay for Roman soldiers. This type of central wall that we've brought out here is very typical of granaries found in other sites around the Roman Empire. We'll see a parallel in just a moment. One of the rooms, the only one in the fort we found so far, had brick paving, brick tiles as the floor. This would be a very dry, fine kind of floor for grain sacks to be placed upon or grain bins. It would be appropriate for the type of structure that we're proposing. And Roman agricultural writers such as Columella suggest that bricks soaked in oil lees, a special type of the leftovers from olive processing, constitute a very good type of floor for a granary. Here are some parallels from Roman military granaries. You see the same type of buttress walls and long, narrow chambers that we're reconstructing here at Humema. Granaries and grain supply, the supply of the troops, is a very important problem at Humema. You can see that there are resources in the region, but could 500 soldiers support themselves just from these local resources? 500 men would require at least 182 metric tons of wheat alone per annum for their sustenance. And of course, besides meat, they would have cheese and certain types of preserved meats and oil and wine. So a good deal of food has to be somehow provided for these individuals in a fairly marginal environment. The Nabataeans certainly could support themselves there. We're not sure if they could support all of these Roman troops as well. Perhaps the Romans themselves were involved in growing some of the grain that they consumed. We can see on Trajan's column, for example, Roman soldiers busy harvesting grain. It might not be grain they planted, but they're at least engaged in some of the agricultural activities. So grain may have come up from Aqaba or across from the plains of Palestine along the Mediterranean Sea, or they might have been purchased somehow from Nabataean farmers in the area, or even grown by the soldiers themselves. Oh, it worked. Okay. Well, we'd probed a good deal of many areas of the fort before this past season, and in 2004, I wanted to start work in the southwestern quadrant of the fort, and Andrew Sherwood from Guelph University was put in charge of this area. We carefully looked it over, found some very heavy walls projecting from the soil sort of toward the center of that quadrant of the fort, and just went to it, laid out some squares, and started excavating. Found a very interesting structure. At first, some plaster bins turned up that I think were associated with some type of textile processing or other industrial undertaking, possibly belonging to the post-Roman period of the fort. But next to it was a very sturdily built room with a stone-paved floor. Whoops. Oops, wait a minute. Okay, there we go. A stone paved floor. We lifted one of the slabs and found there was a drain underneath it, right here. And you see this is, I'm sorry, my pointer seems to have expired, but you see the outline, a rectangular room, very heavy walls, and there's a paved floor. And then we found that there was a gutter going around three sides of the wall and a pipe at this point. So you have a very large terracotta pipe. I can't really see it too well because the slide's not well focused, but it comes in at this point. There's a drain going around the outside, and then it exited here. Well, to anyone who's looked at Roman architecture, this could only be one thing, a latrine, which strikes you as a banal type of structure, but we got very excited about it, being interested in hydrology and the makeup of the fort and the overall provision for the soldiers within the fort. And latrines, of course, are extremely important. When you have a large numbers of individuals in one place, it's important for hygiene and health that the latrines be properly fitted out. And the Romans were very good at it. This was a typical type of Roman structure. You have drains going around the outside, little drains up above to rinse off these sponges that served as toilet paper, and either wooden or stone seats over the trench where the sewage went. Here's a reconstruction of the latrine we saw in the previous photograph at Housestead's Fort in northern Britain. The soldiers all at work, and here they are rinsing off their sponges in this little drain up above. So we found a variety of structures then in the Roman fort, both exalted and banal, bath buildings, headquarters structures, religious structures, and now the most necessary of all, the latrine. The area around the latrine had very interesting fragments of frescoes, richly colored panels that were meant to imitate marble, and then inscriptions, fascinating inscriptions that appear to be, for the most part, in Greek, but we don't have enough connected letters or enough portions of words to figure out what the message of these inscriptions was. We hope to be able to find more traces in the next excavation season. And there were some representations of humans. I think you can see this hand right here, and their portions of bodies and draped forms as well. So there may have been historical or mythological figures, or perhaps representations of individuals who are commemorated in the inscriptions. Well, we may have the officers' quarters. We may have some other type of special dormitory area. We have excavated some of the barracks in the southeast quadrant of the fort. These were inhabited by the soldiers, a large series of small identical rooms during the second and third centuries AD. In the fourth, they seem to have been reoccupied by squatters. There was a forge there in the first period of occupation. What you see on the screen are forge blooms left over from ironworking. And then we found a variety of odds and ends. Here, for example, the cheek piece of a helmet with the leather still attached to it on the inside. You can imagine wearing an iron helmet in the desert. You'd need the insulation on the interior to keep from frying your face. We have iron projectile points, which you would expect in a military environment. Chain mail as well, overlapping bits of iron held together by copper wire. A bit hard to see the scale, but it's scale armor of a type we know was much favored in the Near East. Hobnail boots were important to the Roman soldiers, and you get these little nails with round heads and often curved because they had been driven through the leather and then bent back down again. Well, the fort then has provided us with a great deal of evidence about the Roman and early Byzantine period at Homema, and we also excavated the Vicus, or civilian settlement, just to the south. I'll just show you a few images here, but it's a very important series of interconnected mud brick structures and a shrine at the south end. A bit hard to make sense of this plan. It's a difficult site to unravel, but we've made good progress in this past season. The walls are built of stones set in mud plaster, and then there were mud brick walls on top, several of which have survived after having fallen over in antiquity. And one can make out a series of structures by carefully sifting through the debris. There were several Nabataean structures underneath this later settlement. which seems to have been set up in the course of the second century and then was destroyed just the same time as the fort around 270 or 280 AD and then reoccupied again in the course of the fourth century. Here you see a Nabataean wall from a Nabataean shrine or temple that was set up and which we defined very nicely this past season. It was built in the course of the later first century AD. It had a square shape to it. You can see remains of the walls at this point. It was rebuilt in the course of what was destroyed when the Romans arrived around 106. It then was rebuilt in the course of the second century and served as a place of worship up until the destruction around 270, 280 AD. The focus was this Dushara block. Dushara was the main god of the Nabataeans. And in fact, the mountain just to the north of Humaima is the Al-Shara escarpment. It was named after the god Dushara in antiquity. Traditional Nabataean religion was aniconic. You wouldn't actually show the human figure of the gods. They at first were not thought of as anthropomorphic, and then later on there seems to have been a kind of prohibition against representing the images, just as there is in a strict Islamic religion today. So you would show a pillar instead. And here at the very focus of the shrine is this Nabataean pillar in position, this Dushara block. And in fact, there were several other religious altars around it. When we excavated the structure, it was found that there was a broken altar with a Latin inscription in front, tipped over and lay in position where it had been thrown during the destruction of 270 or 280 AD. When we turned it over, we were very excited to find evidence for the identity of the unit that was stationed in the fort just to the north, because it was dedicated to a pair of emperors for the health of the emperors. They don't give the names. Dedicated to Jupiter Ammon by a vexillation, a unit of the 3rd Legion Cyrenaica, which was an important legion for the occupation of the Nabataean kingdom in the 2nd and 3rd centuries AD. And then it mentions Havara, the Latin name of the town, and then with Julius Priscus. There was a Julius Priscus who was the brother of the Emperor Philip the Arab, that may be the individual mentioned here, or it may be somebody else. In any case, you have a dedication in Latin to a Romanized god. There was a Greek inscription as well to Zeus Serapis, an Egyptian god, but with wider ramifications throughout the empire. This too was found in the same room. And then, of course, we've got the Dushara block at the focus. So we have a series of different religious objects here, objects from different cultures in different languages. They show the cosmopolitan aspect of this site in the course of the 3rd century AD, the time of the destruction. It's very interesting that there is a long processional way, which Barbara Reeves, who's been excavating this portion of the site, she's at Queen's University, found this year. It's a 20-meter long paved area with a gate at the east end. It goes up towards the shrine. You see the Dushara block here. And it may have been intended to show you the Dushara block and the mountain behind. If you recall, the foundation myth of Hawara involved a mountain. It was a camel. He led King Aretas to the site of the town where Aretas saw a mountain firmly rooted in the earth. The Dushara block is often felt to be a representation, a ceremonial representation of a god embodied in a mountain, and all of this ideology may be tied together as part of the foundation myth and part of the traditional Nabataean religious approach. Well, what we see here is a microcosm of the social and economic development of Havara, a mix of languages and cultures and religions. And what's interesting is that we have an 800-year-long political potency of this very small and isolated site. That's what's particularly striking. Havara was founded by one of the most active and successful of the Nabataean kings. It was quickly occupied and fortified by the dynamic Romans after the kingdom was replaced by a new province that dramatically altered the balance of power in the Near East in the early 2nd century. And then finally, Humaima served as the springboard for the Abbasid ascent to the caliphate in the 8th century AD. Why did such a small, isolated, and lightly populated site exert such an attraction or such an influence over such a long period of time? The settlement lacks any strategic advantage and was never surrounded by a wall. Was it the marvel of the spring-fed Nabatean aqueduct and the durable runoff water supply system that attracted people to Humayma? Was it the agricultural land, or was it the sheer emptiness of the desert roundabout in which this one site shone like a bright planet in the desert sky at dawn? Or was there some real magic in the oracle that spoke to Obodas and Aritas and the white camel? Whatever the causes, history came full cycle from the Nabataeans to the Abbasids, following central themes of Arab culture and in constant interplay with outside collective and cultural influences. Thank you. Oh, what protection for the site? There are several local guardians for the site. Their efficacy is somewhat disputed, but basically the site's fairly isolated. However, most of the Bedouin roundabout regard it as part of their heritage, so they make sure nobody else digs there illegally. And since I've employed them all to dig for me over the years, one after the other, they all know that they could work very hard and find nothing commercially valuable, you know, for their efforts. So generally, things are left alone. And it looks as if the government will be able to fund a permanent guardian there fairly soon. But there's no ticket charge. It's a bargain. So if you're in southern Jordan, just drive west of the highway and you can get in there for free. Oh, how many people do I have to employ to get the sand out? I bring along, I have a staff of about 14, and then I bring 10 volunteers along to excavate who help with the digging, and then I employ about 30 Bedouin workers. And the Bedouin workers mainly are doing the shovel and wheelbarrow work, and that's how we get a lot of the material out. But most of the time, excavation doesn't produce huge volumes of dirt very quickly, so it's not a big problem to get rid of the spoil. We pile it up in heaps, and then it's taken away by scooper every year or two.
Yes, the climate today the same as what it was back when civilization was there?
I missed the first part, I'm sorry.
Is the climate the
same? Oh, yeah, is the climate the same? Yeah, we think the climate is very similar. It's drier right now than it has been for a while. And that may be permanent or it may be a short-term oscillation, but I mean, we really, none of us know what's happening right now with the climate. But it's basically the same now as it was in antiquity. We can tell that from historical testimony, from the remains of plants that we find in the soil, from the type of hydraulic structures they built, and from the absence of water erosion in some of the stretches of the aqueduct. I'm not sure, entirely sure of the question, but how far do we go in uncovering?
Kind of like where do you draw the line between, you know, searching and doing excavating and trying to find the map and just leaving a line?
Oh, yeah.
There's loads under there that you can dig in the
Sure. There has to be a balance, and the Jordanian government has been fostering survey work rather than excavation work in many parts of Jordan that are in danger of, where the archaeological sites are in danger of damage from development, particularly around Amman and in the north, where there's a great deal of development going on. So in those regions, there's not a lot of excavation, but there's a lot of survey where you find sites and identify them, and then they're given some legal protection. But in the south, there's not so much danger from development, so the efforts are concentrated on excavation. Furthermore, excavation is a good source of tourism development, and what the Bedouin need right now is some alternatives to their previous method of making a living, which is no longer valid, and there's a lot of unemployment there, so they're trying to develop tourism in the south, and that's one reason they've allowed me to work on this splendid site over many years. Oh yeah. The question was why was the Humayma fort of a European design, and why wasn't that design used elsewhere? There are a variety of reasons. Many military units in the Near East were actually stationed in or adjacent to towns, so they didn't need quite the same sophistication of fortification, or they might be within town walls in a slightly set apart structure. And in addition, they often constructed their forts on the model of pre-existing Greek towns rather than on the European tradition. There's a sort of Near Eastern tradition for fort architecture, but we really don't know much about Roman fort architecture in the Near East in the second century AD, because this is basically the only large fort of what's called the Principate period known in the Middle East, the only large fort from the early second century, or let's say the first century. So it may be that there are a number of others around there, and it's just that they moved on to local traditions of fort design in the course of the third and fourth centuries AD. But we have more or less unique evidence here for Humayma, at Humayma. And what happens, Trajan was moving very quickly across the Near East. He wanted to bring a great many changes to the region of the Middle East and work his way into what's now Iraq. And as a result, he probably had a large corps of engineers set up to set up forts as quickly as possible and obtain his strategic advantage as quickly as possible.
There'll be opportunity to discuss more with our speaker at the session with the coffee and cookies outside. Meantime, I'd like to ask Professor Hector Williams, a classics department of UBC, to thank our speaker.
Mr. Chairman, ladies and gentlemen, it's kind of appropriate this week that we've had two Middle Eastern lectures for the Vancouver Institute, Hans Blix on Monday and Professor Olesen tonight. I think the parallels may have been obvious to many of you in events of the present day, even the present moment in the Middle East and 2,000 years ago when the Romans decided to occupy and pacify the area. The talk that he's given us tonight has made it very clear, however, how important archaeology is to supplement the rather dry and sometimes inadequate historical record that survives in showing us these sites and in showing us how things like destructions that were not known before can be found from the record. Another important point, I think, too, in Professor Olesen's talk, and he gave us a very good one yesterday about his work on concrete technology in ancient harbors, is the significant work that you and we, the Canadian taxpayer, are doing in supporting such projects as these around the world. And one of the best that Canada has is Professor Olesen's in Jordan. So on behalf of all of us, I'd like to thank him for this fascinating presentation this evening.